So I want to tell you a couple of things about how I came to write this book, and then tell you several of the themes I want you to think about while I'm reading a small selection from the book, and then spend most of our time on questions and answers discussion. I think the topic of immigration is one that a lot of people have very strong feelings about, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book, and I hope that we'll have a chance to discuss a lot of those. Around the time of the May 1st Immigrants' Rights Marches in 2006, I was overhearing many conversations and reading many commentaries in the press. I am a historian. I teach history, Latin American history, and U.S. Latino history, so I've taught a lot about immigration over the years, had a lot of discussions in my class about immigration over the years. And as I was listening to the comments, I was struck by how a few stock phrases came up again and again and again. And all of these phrases were sort of abstracted from any cultural, political, or historical context. That is, they were just little short phrases like immigrants take American jobs, or why do people come here illegally? They should come here legally. That to me revealed an utter ignorance of history and political context. And rather than join in and participate in all of these discussions, I found myself sort of sputtering because I was getting so annoyed, which isn't a good position for a teacher to be in. And after one particularly frustrating conversation in my office, I went home and wrote an op-ed, which I sent to my local paper, and they published. And I guess that op-ed got circulated, trying to debunk some of the myths that I thought were underlying what I was listening to people saying. That op-ed got picked up and circulated, and people started talking about it, and someone passed it along to an editor at Beacon Press, who then called me and asked me if I would write a book on immigration. And that's how this book came to be. It was a sort of a fortuitous set of events. Okay, three major themes that I'd like you to sort of keep in your mind, and they're all kind of historical themes, as I'm reading you the introduction to this book. They're all historical and they're all interrelated. The first one is rights. What are rights? Who has rights and why? Who doesn't have rights? Why and how do societies determine that some people should have rights and other people shouldn't have rights? In particular, how has the United States historically divided the population among those who have rights and those who don't have rights? And how does our current situation today grow out of a long historical tradition of unequal rights in this country? So the first topic is rights. The second topic is labor and the economy. I argue in my classes and in this book that the global economy has existed for at least 500 years, since 1492. And we're in a particular phase of a global economy. We call it globalization, but it's not really globalization because the economy of the United States has certainly always been global. And it's been a global economy that's been based on inequality. That is, it's been based on the profit and privilege of some off of the exploited labor of others. This could be a definition of colonialism, and obviously the United States is a product of colonialism. European expansion, which enriched Europe at the expense of underpaid, undercompensated labor, primarily of people of color in Europe's colonies, the transportation of people from Africa to work for the profits of white people in the Americas and in Europe. And that today, too, we're just in a next phase of prosperity for some based on the exploitation of labor of others. And this issue of rights and labor these two issues are very closely intertwined, because the exploitation of labor of some has always been accomplished by finding ways of depriving those people of rights. So if a group of people is, through some sort of legal mechanisms, excluded from rights, they then become available to provide undercompensated labor for the comfort of those who have rights. And the third issue is race and racism. This is clearly very tied up with both rights. Race has often been used as an explanation or justification or mechanism to deprive some people of rights. In the case of the United States, racism has also, and this need for the control of labor of some, has also been very closely tied to the development of the nation, of the state, and of the concept of citizenship in the United States. That is, the decision about who gets rights in this country. So those are the three themes. Does anyone remember what they are? Okay, I'm going to read for about 15 minutes, and then I'll open it up for discussion. Most U.S. citizens, and listen for the three themes as I'm reading. Most U.S. citizens believe that this country is founded on the principle of equal rights. They acknowledge that throughout history, many groups were excluded from access to rights, for example, Native Americans, people of African origin, women. But the story of U.S. history is generally told as one of gradual expansion of rights to new groups of people, until finally, with the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, the last remnants of discrimination and exclusion were presumably removed. To those included in the circle of rights, the exclusion of others has always seemed justified, so much so as to be virtually beyond the bounds of discussion. When the Founding Fathers wrote that, quote, all men are created equal, it was quite obvious to them that women were not created equal to men, and that all men meant white men. It was so obvious that it went without saying. Nobody had to specify. It was just obvious. When Patrick Henry reportedly declared, give me liberty or give me death, he assumed that liberty was something reserved for whites. A slaveholder himself, Henry admitted that slavery was morally problematic. But as sociologist James Lowen writes, Henry's understanding of the discrepancy between his words and his deeds never led him to act differently. As Henry explained, I am drawn along by the general inconvenience of living here without them, i.e., labor. In every generation, people have found rationales for systems of social and legal inequality. Native Americans had no rights in the new country, so their land could be taken for white settlement. Africans had no rights, so it was all right to enslave them. Women had few rights, and their labor was generally unpaid. Contract workers were excluded from most legal rights, and their labor was underpaid. Immigrants, as well as workers in other countries, have also been deprived of rights under U.S. law. Yet their low-paid labor provides the cheap products that our economy depends on. Today, a large and growing portion of our population lives without the full rights of citizenship. Non-citizens work, they pay taxes, go to school, and raise families. They live in our cities and towns. They participate in religious, sports, and community events. They serve in disproportionately large numbers in the military. But both law and popular opinion deem them somehow different from the rest of us and not eligible for the rights and privileges that 90% of the population enjoys. Many societies have struggled with the question of what makes a person eligible for rights. Does everybody have rights simply by virtue of being human, or are rights restricted to a select group in a society? Are rights dependent on something called citizenship? And if so, how is it decided who is a citizen? After World War II, there was a widespread repudiation of the kind of legalized discrimination that many believed had led to the horrors of Nazism. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, passed by the United Nations General Assembly in 1948, upheld the idea that there was no justification for governments excluding certain groups of people from rights. The Declaration asserts in Article 2 that everyone is entitled to all of the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration, without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. In Article 6, it states that, quote, everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. The Declaration is unambiguous. Rights apply to all people. No exceptions, no exclusions. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security provides what it calls a civics lesson to help those people who are eligible for citizenship, a small proportion of the immigrants in the United States, prepare for the test they'll have to take as part of the process. One question reads, whose rights are guaranteed by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? As if that question had an easy answer. In fact, they provide an easy answer, but one that's false, all people living in the United States. The lesson goes on to elaborate. One reason that millions of immigrants have come to America is this guarantee of rights. Kind of strange, since most immigrants are deprived of rights. The Fifth Amendment guarantees everyone in the United States equal protection under the law. This is true no matter what color your skin is, what language you speak, or what religion you practice. The 14th Amendment, ratified after the Civil War, expanded this guarantee of rights. No state would be able to abridge or block the rights of any of its citizens. So there you're setting up a division between who has rights and who doesn't. The reality is a bit more complex. U.S. law has always been and still is restrictive about who deserves rights. Until the Civil War, federal statutes took for granted and upheld the notion that citizenship and rights were based on race. Citizenship was reserved for white people. The distinction was not between native-born and immigrants. That is, our current way of determining citizenship is completely new to the post-Civil War period. Rather, the distinction was between whites, who were citizens, and non-whites, who were not. The 14th Amendment, passed in 1868, for the first time extended citizenship to all persons born in the United States. That is, it established the concept of citizenship by birth. If you were born here, you were a citizen. Except it still excluded Native Americans. It read, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, important qualification, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. So that's an exclusive phrase. That is, you can't abridge the rights of citizens. But then it goes on, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So part of the 14th Amendment applies to all persons, and part of it applies only to citizens. Nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, this within its jurisdiction sounds harmless, but actually, because Native Americans were excluded from legal jurisdiction, it means that they were not eligible for any of these rights. The amendment thus expanded citizenship by partially separating it from race for the first time. Before this, citizenship was restricted to whites, and rights were restricted to citizens. But citizenship was not completely separated from race yet. First, the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof excluded Native Americans, even those born in U.S. territories. Second, anybody born in the United States was automatically a citizen, but still only white people could be naturalized as citizens. The 1870 Naturalization Act, 2 years later, extended the right to naturalize to Africans and people of African descent, but nobody else. So now there were two classes of people, those defined as white, which wasn't defined, and those determined to be African or of African descent who were allowed to naturalize. Citizenship was particularly denied to Asians. That is, they could not naturalize. And the contradiction here between who could be born a citizen and who could naturalize was the reason for the first restrictive immigration laws. That is, the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. The Chinese Exclusion Act prevented Chinese from coming to the United States at all, in part to make sure that nobody of Chinese descent could gain citizenship by virtue of being born here. That is, until citizenship by birth existed, there were no restrictions on immigration. In fact, there was forced immigration of people of color, of people from Africa, to serve as an unexploited labor force. So immigration restrictions begin when citizenship is expanded to everybody born here. So it's sort of an opening and a closing in terms of the racial inclusiveness of the laws. Chinese people were not permitted to naturalize as citizens until 1943. Even then, China was subject to an immigration quota of 100 people per year. Filipinos and Asian Indians were granted the right to become citizens in 1946, and the Asiatic Barred Zone, established in 1917, which forbade anybody from Asia — they weren't quite sure what Asia was either, but anybody from what could be defined as Asia, established in 1917, was not allowed to immigrate. This was abolished in 1952. It was not until 1965, however, that the 100 per year quotas were lifted for Asian countries. The 14th Amendment's second sentence extends rights even more broadly than the first. No person, apparently citizen or non-citizen, can be denied equal protection under the law. The apparent contradiction in the amendment left it up to the courts to rule on what it meant in specific cases. The U.S. Supreme Court has given contradictory rulings. Two important decisions argued that citizenship status could not be used to deprive people of rights. In 1971, the Supreme Court prohibited states from discriminating against legal immigrants in granting welfare benefits. In 1982, Plyler versus Doe ruled that all children have a right to public school education, regardless of legal status. Other decisions, though, allowed states to discriminate, and the 1996 welfare reform incorporated unambiguous discrimination against legal immigrants. That is, they're treated completely differently under the law from citizens. If the 14th Amendment is taken literally, then it is routinely violated in the United States today. Non-citizens are openly denied equal protection, and some of them, those who are undocumented, are denied any protection under the law. Their very existence is termed illegal. In many ways, their situation is comparable to that of African Americans prior to the 1870s, and perhaps also after the 1890s, when Reconstruction's attempts to make citizenship real for African Americans were unraveled. Undocumented persons, and even legal immigrants, may be physically present in the United States, but they are not treated equally under the law. Just as in every period of U.S. history, the law today discriminates by excluding large sectors of U.S. society from its protection and from the very concept of equal rights. Rather than race, ethnicity, or gender, which have been discredited as reasons for excluding portions of the population from access to citizenship, today the dividing line is generally place of birth. Unlike in the past, there's no blanket prohibition on citizenship for any race or nationality of people. Nevertheless, many people in the United States are denied the right to become citizens and denied the rights that go along with citizenship. Just as it seemed obvious to those in power in the past that race, ethnicity, and gender were legitimate reasons to exclude portions of the population from rights, many American citizens today seem to believe passionately in the need to divide the population between citizens and non-citizens, and to divide immigrants between those deemed legal and those deemed illegal. That those classed in the latter category should be denied rights, and that large groups of people should be denied the right to become citizens or to become legal, is considered self-evident. Although the exclusion itself is rarely questioned, resentment against immigrants and attempts to further marginalize them are rampant in today's society. The suggestion that non-citizens, too, are created equal is virtually absent from the public sphere. However, claims that immigrants take American jobs, are a drain on the American economy, could contribute to poverty and inequality, destroy the social fabric, challenge American identity, and contribute to a host of social ills by their very existence are openly discussed and debated at all levels of U.S. society. And I propose that if the group of people who was being accused of creating all of these harmful impacts on society were given any other name besides immigrants, that is, if we used any other term to distinguish them from other people in the society, people would realize how absurd it is to distinguish and characterize people in this way. It's just that somehow the term immigrant has held its weight as a sort of a legitimate way to define who belongs and who doesn't belong. In a series of short chapters, this book seeks to dismantle the myths that inform the major debates about immigration in today's United States. Each chapter seeks to identify and challenge the assumptions that underlie some of the prevailing arguments about immigration. The book challenges the way we understand U.S. economic and immigration history. I argue that since before this country was founded, its economy has been global. The prosperity of some within our borders has always depended on the cheap labor of others from both inside and outside our borders. This cheap labor has been justified and guaranteed by excluding certain workers from the categories of people who are afforded rights. Although race is seldom directly invoked in anti-immigrant discourse today, I argue that race is so deeply tied to ideas about citizenship and immigration that it is central to the discussion. I conclude with an attempt to imagine what a humane immigration policy would look like and how creating a humane immigration policy would connect to other changes at a national and global level.